The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, Corey Lewandowski. And Corey was the guy that got Trump elected, as you know. He was his original campaign manager. It's always good to have him on. And he's now with the Vice President's Political Action Committee, which is the hard money pack, raising money for candidates that support Trump's agenda. He's a senior advisor to the Great America Committee. Corey, great to have you.
Hey, John, how are you doing this morning? Did you see that rally last night or what?
I tell you what, tell us about it. I saw it on TV, but not like being there. What did you think of it?
Look, it's so special for me. I've been to so many rallies, but to see the president fire up a crowd, to talk, to push back on the narrative that the media is going after him on, the Jimmy Kimmel thing, the Jimmy Fallon thing, you know, these liberal elites from Washington and New York who were so thankful to see Donald Trump come and bring them ratings for one of their shows, that what Donald Trump said, and I was there, John, was so true. Jimmy Fallon stood outside like a two-year-old child waiting for candidate Trump to show up. We were there. He treated us like gold. He basically thanked Donald Trump profusely for making him a very high-rated show, and then that was in September of 2015, and now he comes out and attacks him. I mean, this is the worst of the worst, mm-hmm. But the great part is Donald Trump has a microphone to fight back like nobody else, and I love to see him fight. I love him to go and remind the people of South Carolina to support Henry McMaster, who was with us early on in the campaign when right. not many people were. And I love seeing the president in front of the crowds. It fires him up and keeps him ready.
Let me also ask you about the fact that they had an overflow crowd there. And rather than the president go back to his motorcade, to go back to the plane, he went out to mingle and talk with the overflow crowd, right?
That's exactly right, John. You're exactly right. And that's who he is, right? We know that. I mean, it's just how he rolls, and that's why people turn out by the tens of thousands to see him, and they show up, and you've seen it, John, 5, 6, 7 hours ahead of time, and he wants to make sure that he sees every single person because that's the type of person he is.
Let's get to legislative affairs. Neither of the congressional Republican immigration bills are going anywhere. We've heard today from a number of people on the Hill that the second bill, which is basically the watered-down amnesty bill, but $25 billion for a wall, that's going nowhere. But, Corey, even if either of these bills, the Goodlatte bill or this bill, passed with a 60-vote filibuster cloture rule in the Senate, you can't get anything done. What does the president do now?
Well, and the president has tweeted about this, John, and I think he's absolutely right. What he said was, let's not waste time on legislation that isn't going to move forward.
Right.
You have to get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate. So shy of that happening, and look, he will get 5 or 6, maybe 7, Democrat U.S. senators who are up for re-election in states that Donald Trump won 2 years ago to support a piece of legislation. But if you don't change the rule and make it a 51-vote opportunity in the Senate, mm-hmm. then this is all about nothing. And so, you know, members of Congress right now, and the president said this, are wasting their time on a piece of legislation that is perfunctory, that will never move forward, and, you know, doesn't really solve the problem. So what he has said was, hey, let's postpone this issue until after the election. We believe the tea leaves are saying, right, the political experts, if you will, are saying the Republicans are going to pick up seats in the U.S. Senate, and let's try and get this done after we have more votes, or change the rules so that it's a 51-vote majority number in the Senate to move it, and that's the only way it's going to happen.
Do you think there's any chance that Mitch McConnell will ever change that rule?
Look, I don't think so, but I don't understand why. Because when it came down to Neil Gorsuch, he changed the rules so that the U.S. Supreme Court was a simple majority, not a 60-seat, not a 60-vote filibuster. Now, look, I don't, John, I have no inside knowledge whatsoever, zero, none. But what I'm hearing on the ground right now is it sounds like there could be a Supreme Court vacancy in the next 24 to 48 hours being announced. If that is the case, that is another huge opportunity for this administration to continue to reform the court system in a positive manner for conservative values. And that means a 51-vote opportunity in the U.S. Senate. So I don't understand when issues are of massive importance, like a Supreme Court justice, Mitch will change it for a 51-vote in the Senate. But when it's an issue which is very important, like immigration, he holds to 60. Because, look, the Democrats, when if and when they take back the U.S. Senate, which will happen at some day, they don't care about precedent. They will make it a 51-vote opportunity for them because they will want to move their agenda forward.
Let me get back to what you just said about we could have an opening on the Supreme Court within 24 to 48 hours. Did you get that from someone that you think might be reliable?
Well, I don't want to divulge any information, but I can tell you this. It has been widely speculated that another retirement is going to happen in the Supreme Court. The timing is about appropriate right now. As you know, the court is ending fairly soon, their legislative calendar, and it will take some time to vet some additional people. This president, unlike previous ones before him, has already put out a list of potential Supreme Court nominees that he thinks would be qualified and potentially elevated to get to that.
Right.
And so I can tell you that the administration will be ready if that vacancy comes to fruition. And the and what I'm hearing here in Washington today is that many, many people believe in 24 to 48 hours there could be an announcement that somebody is going to be retiring from the court, and then we would be gearing up potentially after the August recess in September for a second Supreme Court nomination.
Well, that would be big. No question about it. We're with Corey Lewandowski, former campaign manager for the Trump for President campaign. He's the person that engineered the stunning victory. He's also the author of one of the best book written in the campaign. It's a must buy. You got to buy it. Buy it now. Go to Amazon or your favorite bookstore. Let Trump Be Trump by Corey Lewandowski. Let Trump Be Trump. I've got three copies. One for me. I gave one to my oldest son, one to my wife. I've read it two times. It's a fun read. Let Trump Be Trump. Buy it now. It is. You really enjoy it, especially with the summer coming up. You're at the beach or the pool or whatever. It's a really fun read and very interesting. And it's going to make you inspired. It's also going to make you laugh. It's great. Let Trump Be Trump. Don't delay. Buy it now with Corey Lewandowski. He's now the senior advisor to the Vice President's Great America Committee, Political Action Committee. Corey, I want to get your comment on Mark Warner. Now, look, I'm all for humor and joking. The president, as you know, you know him better than anybody. He has a great sense of humor. He makes fun of stuff all the time. He laughs constantly. People don't realize that about him. So Mark Warner, senator from Virginia, former governor, a good friend of mine, by the way, good personal friend, was at a retreat in the Martha's Vineyard with all the Democratic senators. They were doing a fundraiser. He had a few drinks. And he says, hey, get me another glass of wine, and I'll tell you all about the conversation I've had with Mueller and all the stuff that's going to be coming out in the next several months. You better fasten your seatbelts. Now, he said it in jest, and he was having a good time. So I get that. But one thing that struck me about it, it's almost got me to believe that Mueller is working with the Democratic Party before the midterms, because why would he be giving this information to Warner and not his Republican counterpart? That just seemed like an odd statement to me.
You know, John, it was a very odd statement. And what's even more surprising is that it got out. And the reason is, obviously, I think Mark was kidding. I don't know Senator Warner. I don't think he would ever divulge the information that he has due to his relationship. They've had a very strong bipartisan relationship on the committee where he is the ranking member on. But let me say this. You know, I'm very concerned that this investigation continues to move forward. I think it has to be brought to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. We have now seen through the investigator the IG report, right, that there was nothing here other than some bad hombres in the FBI with Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who had a vendetta against candidate Trump, who will do anything to stop him from being the president. He beat all of them, and now we know that they use their bias to start this investigation when they could have been looking at Hillary Clinton. We know that they changed the wording in the Clinton investigation so that she would stay on the ballot and not be prosecuted for criminal negligence. And so, look, there's so many things here, and my concern is that Senator Warner should be calling for an end to the investigation, and more openly, he should be calling for an investigation into Jim Comey and McCabe, and there should be, with the criminal referral that Andrew McCabe has received, I don't understand how the IG's report has not been acted on, and Andrew McCabe has not been brought in to jail for lying under oath to the FBI on at least three documented occasions. I don't understand how this isn't moving forward. And John Warner, who, while he is a Democrat, has historically not been a complete partisan,
right,
should be leading the effort to get that done, and it's disappointing that he hasn't.
I think that's where he has to go with it. I do agree with you. I think he was joking, and I think it's okay in Washington to have a sense of humor. Corey, as you know, they take things very serious here. But it does raise the question to why isn't he acting on the Inspector General's report? They don't even care about it. In fact, they've done the opposite. They've discredited it, which is amazing to me. And that's where the bipartisanship goes away. We're out of time. I want to thank Corey Lewandowski for being with us today. He's senior advisor of the Great America Committee. That's the Vice President's Political Action Committee, raising money for candidates supporting the president's agenda. It's always good to have you, sir. Don't forget, go to Dalton Bookstores, any bookstore you have, or Amazon, and buy his book, Let Trump Be Trump. Thanks for being with us, man. Joining us now is Rabbi Mentkin. And Rabbi and I met some time back, and we've talked several times at CPAC and other things, and it's great to have him on our show. Rabbi, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Rabbi, what a day yesterday, right? And I know you're part of a Jewish organization in New York. So tell us a little bit about that, and then I want to get your thoughts on the Supreme Court ruling on Tuesday.
Well, there are two Supreme Court rulings we really have to talk about when you think about it, because it was a delightful day for religious liberty as well as Trump's authority to protect our borders. But the Coalition for Jewish Values was created about a year and a half ago. We are a new organization that has stepped forward to express how the Jews who actually keep our faith and traditions feel about values issues. Because unfortunately, so much of the dialogue that you hear in public is distorted. Actually, it's true that our president is in New York and our vice president, but I am actually in Baltimore, so I'm quite nearby to you. But that's how we met at CPAC, actually. We represent rabbis all over the country, and we have on our board rabbis from all over the country, from California to the East Coast.
So tell us about the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, 5-4, basically saying that the president has the authority to ban the entrance into the United States of certain countries. That's within his authority. Do you agree with that, and why not, Rabbi?
We certainly do agree with it, because the ban is not in any way singling out a people or a religion. It is singling out countries which are, first of all, breeding grounds for not only hatred of America, but for terrorism, for the idea that you can go and murder those with whom you disagree and hate. And also, they don't have procedures, good procedures in place, to allow the United States to specifically identify whom they wish to exclude. So the United States has to take a more radical measure of saying, we're not going to let anybody in from those countries until we vet them more carefully.
I don't think there's any question that the president absolutely has the right to ban countries, right? Because if you're from another country, you have no rights in the United States. This is what I never really even saw this debate. I mean, you have no rights. If you're coming across the border illegally, you have no rights. You're not a citizen. And so somehow we've got this thing so garbled. Anyway, we are with Rabbi Yaakov Menken. He is with the Coalition for Jewish Values. Your organization also commended Senator Ted Cruz for his idea in order to solve the crisis at the border that we have now. Rabbi Menken, can you elaborate on that?
The reason to praise Ted Cruz was he was trying to propose a sincere solution to the problem. People are pretending that the situation prior to President Trump's zero-tolerance policy was actually good, that things were okay. And they really weren't okay. They were facilitating child trafficking and child abuse. There was an incentive in place for an individual not related to a child to bring that child across the border and claim to be that child's parent. And then, once they were freely on the other side of the border, they would receive that brief hearing where they were told to appear later for a court date, and then they were released, quote-unquote, together to be allowed to stay with their child. Mm-hmm. And they would promptly abandon the child if they were actually, if they were child trafficking, the best that the child could hope for was to be abandoned. The other possibility was slavery. I mean, it was a horrible situation, and that was true because an unaccompanied adult would be detained. So there again, we're incentivizing bringing a child across the border, whether or not it's actually a relative.
I couldn't agree more. I think you summed that up very well. We're with Rabbi Menken. He's with the Coalition for Jewish Values. That is the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. They articulate an advocate for public policy positions based upon traditional Jewish thought. One of the rabbis in your organization, Rabbi Fisher, yesterday came out with a very strong statement. There was a letter signed by two national Orthodox organizations, Rabbi Menken, that basically was condemning Trump. And Rabbi Fisher said, look, you know what? This makes no sense. And these organizations are not representative of majority Jewish thought in America. Can you elaborate on that?
I have to be completely honest with you, yesterday being what it was with the number of decisions rolling around, I have not yet personally seen Rabbi Fisher's essay on the topic. However, in which area was it talking? Was it talking about the immigration issue?
Yes, yes.
And I think that there was a certain amount of widespread disappointment. In particular, it wasn't even what they said, but there were two national organizations that joined in a statement with a group of left-wing organizations whose hostility to the president is knee-jerk reactionary. You know, it doesn't matter. If Donald Trump said that the sun rises in the east, they would oppose him.
Right.
And, you know, there are just certain there's a wing of the liberal movement, the Democratic Party, that has just decided to, quote unquote, resist.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever Donald Trump says is wrong by definition, to the point of saying, and here we go back to the immigration issue, the very same things said by Bill Clinton, by Barack Obama, and even by Hillary Clinton, when President Donald Trump says the exact same words, it's racist.
So
if that's your thinking,
right,
then it should be obvious that you cannot have a rational objection to Donald Trump on any policy. Even if you wish to disagree with him on the policy, don't sign on with organizations that are simply there because they hate Trump for breathing.
Look, I'm glad you pointed that out because that's what a lot of us deal with. I want to get your take. Last week, Jared Kushner, senior counselor to the president and President Trump's son-in-law and a top aide, were going around the Middle East, meeting with various heads of state and trying to gain support for what they call the ultimate plan. This is going to be a plan to bring peace to the Israeli-Palestinian question. I'm not sure what progress they made. It seemed to me, Rabbi, that what Kushner was attempting to do was what I'm going to call triangulation, right? Basically, they feel their relationship with Israel is so strong, they've got so many chips they're owed, that they can eventually bring the Israelis to the negotiating table. And so I think what he did is he went to the Gulf states, starting with the Saudis. He went to MBS and he said, look, you need to bring pressure on President Abbas and Palestinians and the Palestinian state to get to the table. And obviously we've backed your, you know, your power grab, and we've backed a lot of things that you're trying to do. And then he went to Egypt and President Sisi and others. So it seems like they're trying to get everybody else on board, and that eventually President Abbas is going to have to come to the table, especially if the Saudis and Egypt are demanding it. And they have a common enemy, obviously, in Iran. So, and then they feel, I think, they can eventually convince Israel they have to deal with some negotiations. How do you see this playing out, Rabbi?
Well, the first thing is, I don't think that there's ever been a difficulty getting the Israelis to come to the negotiating table. There has never been a time when the Israelis have, even for a minute, said, we have to have preconditions, the following has to be done, the following has to be in place before we negotiate. This is the classic Arab-Palestinian tactic. It has been, that's what they did with Obama, where Obama pressured the Israelis into doing a total freeze on construction in the settlements, and to the point where a person couldn't put an extra room on their house. You couldn't remodel your house, you couldn't remodel your kitchen, you couldn't remodel your patio. And what did they get for it? Absolutely nothing. So the Israelis have always been willing to come to the negotiating table. What Abbas is doing is just stepping it up. The problem with any sort of peace plan right now is that they are unrealistic at the outset, and I don't really think that's Kushner's fault. I think President Trump is saying to him, you're going to be the architect for our peace plan. And I don't know if they don't know going in that this is going to be a lead balloon, that's not really going to happen. But this way, it's just going to showcase who is actually being the intransigent party. You are right about one thing, which is that the Arab world really feels beholden to Donald Trump right now, which is a surprising statement and yet absolutely true because of the Iran deal. The only people who were more certain than Israel that this deal was a disaster is the Saudis, if you remember.
Yes,
Saudi Arabia was absolutely terrified at what Obama was doing to Iran, or with Iran, and allowing Iran to do. And now that there is a pushback against that, the Saudis and other Arab leaders feel beholden to Donald Trump.
Well, and I think, you know, the other leverage, I believe, that the Trump administration has over the Saudis right now and over their leader, MBS, is very simple. I mean, the Trump administration basically looked the other way when he attempted to consolidate power, arrested all those people, put him in the Ritz-Carlton, said there was corruption. But, I mean, what he was doing was getting rid of the ruling council and basically making it a one-rule state. I mean, that's what MBS is in the middle of doing. And don't you agree that the Trump administration basically didn't do anything about it? They just looked the other way, so it was a tacit approval. I think based on that, and based on some of the other things the administration has done, I think the president has accumulated a number of chips with the Saudis that eventually there's going to come a time where he's going to play them. What do you think?
It could be. I mean, the fact is that the president has been incredibly busy with foreign policy and has done some incredible things that nobody anticipated, most recently with North Korea. But I simply don't think that they have the ability to prioritize dealing with every country's internal affairs. If
right.
The Saudis have been doing the following to consolidate their control of their people, it was a pretty much an authoritarian state from the get-go.
Right.
Remember, they only recently decided that it's going to be legal for women to drive after all.
Right.
And
right.
It's still not legal for women to go out without a chaperone. It's
right.
Not particularly a pro-human rights, modern 21st century democratic state.
Not exactly.
You know, and that has never been the case. So I don't know that I regard the transformation as dramatic as you're saying, in that it's simply it's the Saudis being Saudis.
All right. Well, look, I appreciate your perspective. We have to have you on a continual basis. Rabbi Yaakov Menken, thank you for being with us. He is with the Coalition for Jewish Values. CJV is the acronym. the largest rabbinic public policy organization in the United States. Rabbi Menken, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate your perspective. Thank you, sir.
WBOB News Time, it's 3:30.
With SRN News, I'm Ron DeRockstra. President Trump says he'll announce his pick for the Supreme Court after Independence Day. The president says he'll reveal his consideration for the seat being vacated by retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy on Monday, July 9th. A candlelight vigil held in Annapolis, Maryland last night to honor the five people killed, one injured in a shooting Thursday at a newspaper office. Over 1,000 people attended, gathered to remember the employees of the Capital Gazette. The alleged shooter has been charged with five counts of first-degree murder in one of the deadliest attacks on journalists in U.S. history. The president says he's received assurances from Saudi Arabia's King Salman that the kingdom will increase oil production maybe up to 2 million barrels in response to turmoil in Iran and Venezuela. The Saudis acknowledged the call, but they've made no reference to any production targets. This is SRN News.
Download WBOB's mobile app for free from your app store. Powered by Duval County Judicial Candidate Kimberly Sadler.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for a healthcare plan, or more importantly, if you signed up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare. MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have hundreds of thousands of members all across the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2.5 billion of each other's medical bills. Best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. Your savings may be less or more, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. Here's the number to find out more. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 877-64-BIBLE. That's 877-64-BIBLE. 877-64-BIBLE.
Hey, folks, Dave Ramsey here. Stop wasting money on bottled water and hard water costs. Get yourself a Kinetico system, the only non-electric water-powered hybrid on the market to both soften and filter your water. Go see my friends at CGC Water, a third-generation family business for over 65 years, and your local authorized Kinetico dealer. With the Kinetico system, you can save money on water heating bills and cleaning supplies. You can spend less time cleaning soap scum, lime scale, and spots on dishes and glasses. It removes chlorine so your skin and hair feel softer, and it helps prevent laundry fading. Plus, a Kinetico system can actually lengthen the life of your appliances that use water up to 50%, and it protects your pipes from buildup. You can trust Kinetico. Get a Kinetico system today and start saving money. Call CGC Water at 904-645-6060 or visit cgcwater.com.
WBOB tackles the issues.
When I look at some of these mass shootings that have happened in the past, a lot of these teachers had to sacrifice themselves to protect their students. Well, why not put them in the best position to fight back?
Every day.
Federal district judge in California expanded the ruling to say that even accompanied children can't be held for more than 20 days. I don't see how they can unless Congress gets its act together and passes legislation.
WBOB, your 2018 election authority. The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
Well, the roadway is very slippery out there. Be careful. There is an accident on the west side, I-10 eastbound, around the Cecil Commerce Center. Be careful there. And on, I-95 northbound before Emerson, there's some emergency road construction. Two of the left lanes are blocked. It looks more like a parking lot than an interstate highway right now. Severe thunderstorms across the area for the next 15 or so minutes, and then maybe it'll calm down a bit.
What a day yesterday. It was primary day. It was also quite the ruling for the Supreme Court yesterday in a 5-4 ruling, as I know you've heard over and over. We played two clips on it. I was on CNN twice yesterday. And that ruling, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision rules that the travel ban instituted by the President of the United States is constitutional, and they overturned the Ninth Appellate Court and other lower courts, the one in Hawaii, saying that the ban is within the framework of the Constitution that allows the president the authority in order to do this. Now, here's the key, and this is why this was a great decision yesterday. A great decision because the justices, five of them, did not rule based on legislating from the bench, based on rhetoric, based on what comments the president made in his campaign speeches or during the candidacy. They ruled based on interpreting the Constitution of the United States, which is their job. Good or bad, that's what they did. And quite frankly, when Roberts ruled in favor, John Roberts, in favor of Obamacare, and said that essentially this is a tax and Congress has the right to impose a tax on whoever they want, much to the chagrin of many of us who are upset by it. But for John Roberts, that was the proper interpretation of the Constitution. I mean, we passed a law that said if you don't have insurance, you're going to get a tax. You can call it a fine. It's a tax. Roberts was right. I defended him on it. Upset by it, but defended him. Here, five of these justices nailed it. And this is not about banning Muslims or a race or a religion. It's about eight countries that have basically no laws, that's whose governments have collapsed. They don't even have paperwork on these people. They can't possibly vet them. And so the president has said, in order to ensure the safety of Americans, you're not going to be able to come in from these eight countries. Too bad. Not going to be able to do it. And I think he did the right thing. And he's vindicated now with this decision. Joining us now from Egypt, our man in the Middle East, Eddie Iranian. And we're going to get the reaction from Muslim countries that he talks to every day in his reporting. Eddie Iranian is a veteran with CBS Radio News. He's based in Egypt, and he's also a Voice of America reporter. Eddie, great to have you, man.
Thank you, John. Sort of mixed reaction. The rulers of a lot of Arab states are supporting the Trump administration, whereas popular reaction, I think people are saying there's a bit of racism involved in this decision. That's what popular opinion is from some people. I wouldn't say all people. I think I've spoken to some people who travel to the United States and who seem to understand what's going on. So, as I said, it's not a clear-cut reaction, but there are other things going on that people are pointing out in the Arab media, which is the immigration flux that we've seen to Europe from Turkey and from Libya. Those are the two vectors where it's coming from. They're both in the hands of Muslim Brotherhood leaders, rulers, groups. And the Egyptian press has suggested in the past that the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to flood Europe with people coming from Arab countries. So some suggestion that there's a political motivation to that. And if there is, it's certainly drawing a reaction from the Europeans, which you can see in places like Hungary and Croatia, France. The Popular Front, National Front in France, was very popular during the last election, although it did not win the election. And in the Netherlands, also very strong populist movement. And Angela Merkel, of course, as we've seen, is under threat from the Bavarian party, which is threatening to pull out of her coalition over the immigration issue. So a lot of things going on that don't meet the eye. And some countries are reacting, like we're seeing in the U.S. Also, Algeria has been much more forceful than the Trump administration. They've marched people out of the country, and of course that entails going through the Sahara Desert. So the Arab media was saying that people have died since it's very hot, and not everyone has the money for transportation on a vehicle. I don't know anyone has any solid figures, but certainly Algeria has been much more cruel than the Trump administration, if people are arguing that the Trump administration has been cruel.
So I guess my question is this ban on these eight countries, and basically, whether you want to call it a Muslim ban, it's not. What the Supreme Court said, Edward, is that, you know, because it's not targeting a religion, because we allow many countries that are very majority Muslim, like Indonesia, they're not on the list, obviously, so they can come in. So the Supreme Court looked at this and said, look, this isn't a religious or racial ban. This is just eight countries that the president thinks has problems. But you know what's interesting about this, Eddie, and I want to get your comment on this, is President Obama did the same thing. And there was not a word about it when he attempted to do it. And so that's what really flummoxes me, is that Obama did the same thing and it was like everybody said fine. And now Trump does it. And you would think this guy was the worst man in the history of the world. Right?
Well, there's obviously no logic or rhyme or reason to many of the things the media says. It just boils down to the fact that they supported Obama and that they are trying to get rid of President Trump. I think that's the only way you can understand it, because if you look at logic, there is really no logic in a lot of the things they say and do. Of course, it is easy to stir up anger over any particular move that a government makes, especially when you can have video or audio of children crying. But at the same time, as I said, a lot does not meet the eye. And as you pointed out, many Muslim countries like Egypt do have the ability to send people to the U.S. Egypt was not targeted by that decision. Neither were the countries of Lebanon, neither the Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf states. So many Muslim countries, if not the majority, were not affected by this ruling. And of course, Yemen, the government has completely fallen apart. There are actually two operating governments, no real borders to speak of, unclear who gets a passport. The Saudi coalition was showing forged passports that the Houthi rebels were bringing in from the port of Hodeidah. So it's, you know, anyone can get a hold of a Yemeni passport.
Right.
Syria, well, the government controls parts of the country. There are also a lot of territory that is not under the control of the government, terrorist groups operating in those areas, and refugees from many of those areas are most likely to be the people coming into the country, not the ones coming from the government side of the line. So clearly there is motivation for a travel ban. So I would say that the Trump administration was within its rights, and there is a lot of logic to having such a ban. That being said, the perception, of course, in this part of the world by some people, mm-hmm. not all, is that it had something to do with religion. You can't avoid people thinking that.
Quick update here. Major statement on presidential power by the Supreme Court of the United States, as you know, ruling yesterday, upholding President Trump's ban on travel from several countries, I think eight of them, countries that are predominantly Muslim, but many countries that are much more predominantly Muslim, like Indonesia, not on the list, and also on the list, Venezuela and North Korea, which have very few Muslims in them. I don't think Korea has any. The court's liberals, though, denounced the decision, which Justice Sonia Sotomayor compared to the 1944 ruling that upheld the detention of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. So the hysteria on the left beyond the pale. All right, Eddie Uranian live in Cairo. Thank you for that great update, Eddie. I really appreciate it. You are the man. Thanks for being with us. Joining us now is Saeed Arakat. He is a correspondent and a political analyst of Al-Quds Daily Newspaper, which means Jerusalem in Arabic. So they're based in Jerusalem. And Sayed is the veteran Washington, D.C. correspondent for Al-Quds. Sayed, great to have you with us.
Yes, I am.
Hey, you know, we had a great debate on the set in Arabic of Al Jazeera the other day. I think that was on Friday. I really enjoyed it. and I enjoyed your perspective. And I want to get your take on your take and then kind of what the reaction has been in Jerusalem. But first, with your personal take on the Supreme Court ruling yesterday and the President Trump 8-country travel ban. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a bad day for definitely for Muslim Americans, and it is a bad day for the legacy of the United States and the history of the United States. These kind of things, John, have been tried before, and they simply just don't work. And unfortunately, we saw a Supreme Court decision that was just completely taken along party line or along ideological line. We had the 5 conservatives on the court vote for the president ban, and then 4 against. But in fact, there was a very compelling case made by Justice Sotomayor. So I think it will further the sort of the split and the differences and the gap in America on what is right and what is not right. Now, that is not to say that there ought not to be measures in place or placed to ensure the security of the United States, and that is a primary concern. But to target Muslim countries and then, you know, in a way, to sort of introduce North Korea and Venezuela to make it okay, so to speak, and say this is not really targeted for Muslim, it's just, in my view, it's a political underhandedness. So it is not good. I don't think that it will probably last, much as we have seen with the internment of the Japanese right after World War II. So we'll see. But all in all, I think Muslim Americans feel less American today than they did last week.
Let me ask you this. You said this has been tried before and right. It's failed. Syed, can you elaborate on that? Like, what's
well,
your analogy?
You know, remember, in 1944, the Supreme Court took a decision, very similar decision, to intern Japanese Americans in camps based on security issues. And it turned out many, many years later that it was actually based on, you know, I don't want to say a lie, but maybe a lie, you know, so it was based on, you know, distortion of information and so on, where the United States government had to apologize and, as you saw yesterday, took opportunity to make it, you know, completely null and void. So there has been efforts in the past to do this kind of thing and to target ethnic groups and their, you know, coming into this country based on their religion and their ethnic background. This does not work. What needs to be put together and honed is really a proper immigration policy, a proper security apparatus and analysis and so on to allow those who are, you know, the simple folks that just want to come to visit and work and study in the country and to allow them in and then to, you know, to stop those who, you know, may have ill intentions, so to speak, from coming into the country.
All right, so, Syed, two things I just want to comment on. When you draw the analogy for this travel ban to Japanese internment camps during the Second World War, I think that's a tough analogy to make because those were U.S. citizens that were being interned. I mean, they right. had rights as citizens, and that, I think, was a very dark day, a very dark period in the history of the United States, no question. But how do you compare that to people that are in other countries that, as far as American citizens are concerned, have no rights in the U.S.? There's no right that says you can come into the U.S. Whenever you please. I mean, we have laws. We are a country. And, I mean, you try to get in Israel, you just can't walk in. They've got walls and they've got security and everything else. So, I mean, I think that's a stretch, Syed, to draw that analogy, isn't it?
Well, I mean, we can go through discussing the, you know, the philosophy of these analogies forever, and so on. But look at it this way: when you begin with such a step, then, you know, what about those who are citizens in this country? What about Muslims who are citizens? They begin to feel profiled. They begin to be, in fact, targeted as they come into the country or leave the country and so on just regular everyday business kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. They will be profiled at the airport. They will be profiled by law enforcement agencies, by many, many others. There's tremendous fear among Muslim Americans, you know, many who are third or fourth generation in this country. So they feel somehow targeted for profiling. So on the merit of it, when you begin to target any group because of their belief, whether religious or but because of their even, you know, political beliefs and so on, then we are heading down a slippery slope. That's what you have to be careful and cautious about. Remember, this country was founded on freedom of religion, mm-hmm. on freedom of religion. And really, there is enough in the president's rhetoric. Ever since he began his campaign, you know, since December, at least, since December 2015, the president began to speak very openly about disallowing Muslims from entering into the country. So mm-hmm. the intent was there to profile Muslims. That is the fear, John, and not basically the analogy, whether it's, placing Americans who have been interned in these camps in California and elsewhere to the decision that was taken yesterday. On its own merit, this decision is really ill-advised.
We're with Syed Arakat. He's a senior political analyst and correspondent for Al-Quds Daily newspaper. Al-Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic, and they are the Jerusalem Daily newspaper. Syed, we talked about this on the Al Jazeera panel on Friday, and we didn't agree on this either, but I really want to get your take. Jared Kushner is trying very hard to put what they call the ultimate deal together, the ultimate peace treaty, peace agreement between the Palestinians and Israel. And as I said on the panel on Friday, I think the process is triangulation. They want to get everybody involved, make President Abbas of Palestine come to the table and negotiate, leverage the Israelis to come to the table, give up some stuff, negotiate, and they're bound by a common enemy, right, which is Iran. How do you see this playing out?
Well, first of all, the Palestinians have negotiated directly with the Americans, or under the tutelage, really, of the United States of America, under the guidance of the U.S., United States, since 1988, and fully complete engagement, where the process was completely controlled by the U.S., since 1993, the Oslo Agreement, which was signed on September 13, 1993, at the White House. So to say that the Palestinians, are not negotiating is not true. They have negotiated for over a quarter of a century. These negotiations took place all over the world, including Washington, the White River, Annapolis, many, many other places in our area, Camp David, you name it. And it was supposed, when the agreements were signed back in 1993, it was supposed that within 5 years the Palestinians will have their state, their independent state. We've never seen anything like that. We have seen only the exacerbation and the acceleration, really, of the settlement process, the erection of walls, the separation of communities, 750 checkpoints, scores thousands of Palestinians in prison and so on, and the besiegement of Gaza for 10 years, which has created a human disaster, or a looming human disaster, a humanitarian disaster that could happen at any minute. So, and this was all done, under administrations that time and again, whether it's Bill Clinton's administration or George W. Bush administration or Obama administration, they all agreed to a basic American tenet, basic American belief, and basic American commitment that there will be an independent state on land occupied on June 5th, 1967, with East Jerusalem as its capital. So when you have this administration come in and basically undo American position over a long, long time, over a period of 40 years or 50 years, mm-hmm. Then, I don't think we are starting on the right foot. Mm-hmm. I don't think this process will go forward, and I don't think that peace will be achieved or a settlement reached.
What is your vision of peace? I mean, do you see in your vision, is it a goal to have a two-state solution as the ultimate answer? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, first of all, the two-state solution has basically, I think the time for the two-state solution has probably passed. That ship has sailed to achieve it. So, unfortunately, we don't see this as happening in the future unless there are drastic measures that would be taken by the United States to pressure Israel and just not only pressure it, but impose a settlement on it, which is not likely to happen. So, in the absence of that, what you have is two things for Israel. It cannot be democratic and Jewish at the same time. If it wants to be democratic, then it must be democratic to all its citizens. Now what you have, there are as many Palestinians between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea as you have as many Palestinians as you have Jews. If you're going to deny 50% of the population, maybe a little more than 50%, rights, human rights, civil rights, political rights, and so on, the right to representation, the right to freedom, the right to worship, the freedom of speech, all these things. If you're going to deny them, then what you will end up with is an apartheid-like situation, and that's what you have today. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. If they if they want to be Jewish, then they will cease to be democratic. If they want to be democratic, then they must include, they have to be inclusive to include those Palestinians that are under their control.
Are you looking for Palestinian citizenship in Israel? I mean, is that your goal? Or the goal of what a peace would look like?
Michael, I'm an analyst. You know,
right. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Not your goal. But is it the goal of...
Of course I have a goal. I'm a Palestinian, too. So,
right.
You know, what I'm saying is that what I want to see is an end to the oppression of the Palestinians, an end to apartheid-like targeting of Palestinian citizens. I want to see these walls come down. My village, Abu Dis, which has, you know, been talked about as perhaps the future capital of the Palestinians, and it sits right just to the east of Jerusalem. The wall goes 26 feet high, John. So it is, you know, it is dissecting communities. I'll give you an example, a family example. I have my first cousin who used to have like a 5-minute walk or less than 5-minute walk to her daughter's home. Now she has to go 26 kilometers because the wall comes right smack in the middle. So I want to see people have freedom. I don't want them to be targeted. I don't want for the Israeli army, an occupation army, to target Palestinians and assassinate them as we have seen, you know, willfully, as we have seen in Gaza time and time again. I want that siege to be lifted. I want Palestinians who are quite industrious and very resourceful type of people, I want them to be able to go around the world and engage and learn and come back and bring in towns and have room to prosper. I want to see their children grow up without fear, go to schools and so on, and not being raided in the middle of the night and taken away, as we have seen with a 16-year-old just a few months back at the Mimi. So this is what I want to see. I want to see freedom. We want to see absence of repression, not only Israeli repression, but also repression that is meted out against the public by the Palestinian Authority. So that is my goal. And I feel that when you have a country, much like our country, where it is inclusive, where, you know, it is for all its citizens, then that would be a tremendous goal to achieve.
All right, I've got 1 minute, but I do have one question from one of our listeners, John, in Yorktown, Virginia, who says, could you ask Syed, what about freedom of religion in Muslim countries? How do you respond to that?
Absolutely. I think most Muslim countries practice repressive measures against non-Muslims, and I think that must end and must end completely. We see great examples where there's a lot of religious tolerance in Jordan and among the Palestinians. You know, growing up, we never knew who was Christian and who was Muslim, to be quite honest, because the society was the same. And, you know, on Sunday, Christians and Palestinians are, you know, of course, a big portion of Palestinians are Christian, would go to church. Muslims might go on Friday to the mosque. So absolutely, I think that the kind of repression that is being practiced by some of the Arab countries against non-Muslim must end, because it is criminal, not only illegal.
All right, Syed Arakat, we're out of time. Syed Arakat, a senior correspondent and political analyst for Al-Quds Daily newspaper in Jerusalem. Thanks for that great analysis. I look forward to continuing our dialogue on the panel of Al Jazeera, where everybody talks Arabic and I talk English, right? Sometimes I got to follow you going that way. Thank you.
You did quite well.
Thank you. I'm getting.